Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Greenberg. I'm an alcoholic. Got my first resentment already. I'm from Staten Island. And my home group is Common Solution Group. My sobriety date is September 25th, 1988, and I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I stand before you just through the grace of God, through nothing that I did. My home group's like this one. It's a very sick group. All home group members believe that we all have one solution, a common solution. We even go so far as to use our last names because we believe we understand what anonymity is. Did I piss anyone off yet?
No.
Okay. Give me a chance. I brought my Al-Anon with me, Joanne. And that's a trip in itself, being married to an Al-Anon. I found out we both love the same person. I found out that, the best way is to tell a story. This winter, Joanne said, "Honey, you have to layer up before you go outside." I said, "I'm okay." She said, no, you have to layer up." I said, "Baby, I'm okay." She said, "You have to layer up." And I used that word she hates to hear, release. And I started to sing that song, "Please Release Me." She said, "I'll release you when you do what I want." And she started to sing the Alcoholics Anonymous song, "I Was Always On My Mind." It's hard to win with you, Joanne. Joanne bought me this shirt. I didn't have much to say about it. But I didn't say, "Release me." I said, "Okay, honey." So there's hope for me. It's good to be here. I'm working on keeping stories that I hear confidential. But Chris Schroeder told me a story that I promised I would never tell. But I figured, to hell with it, I'll tell it and I'll make amends if it pisses him off. You guys want to hear my Chris Schroeder story?
Yeah.
This one is different, Chris. This is the one I said I'd never tell. When Chris was drinking, Chris went into the bar. And he walked in, and there was this big bottle stuffed with $10 bills. And you know Chris and money. He looked at that. He figured out there's about $12,000 or $14,000 in there. He said to the bartender, "Bartender, what's that?" The bartender said, "That's a pool we have here. You put your money in, you complete three tasks, and you win the money." Chris said, "Great, what's the three tasks?" Bartender said, "First, put your $10 in." Chris put his $10 in. The bartender said, "The first task is you have to drink a bottle of tequila. You have to drink it within 3 minutes, and you can't change your facial expression. The next task is we have a big old pit bull chained up outside with a bad tooth. You got to get that tooth out. And the third one is, we have a 75-year-old lady upstairs who's a virgin." Now, Chris, he's no fool. He said, "I'm not doing that." But Chris started to drink. And just like Bill, as he drank, that old fierce determination to win came back. You know how we are when we have a few drinks. I could do anything. Chris said, "I'm ready. Give me that bottle of tequila." Opened that bottle, drank it down, didn't change his facial expression. 2 minutes, 12 seconds, a new record. He says, "Now where's that pit bull?" They said, "Right out that door." Chris went out to that door, and you heard barking, growling, screaming. You heard moaning. You heard shirts ripping, clothes ripping, flesh getting clawed, blood all over the place. And Chris came back in. And he was a mess. He was bleeding. His clothes were just about hanging on. And Chris said, "Now where's that old lady with a bad tooth?" And if there was no joy in sobriety, why would the newcomer want it? And it's good to be able to laugh, because there was a time that I couldn't laugh. I had my second drink at age 21. The first drink I had at age 11. And my father made me drink a shot of scotch right then. And it was the worst crap I ever tasted in my life. I almost died. I almost choked. That experience was sufficient enough for me not to drink for the next 12 or 13 years. On my engagement party, upstate New York, it was like a scene from Deliverance. They had something called white lightning. And my future in-laws told me I had to have some. And I had some. And immediately something happened to me. That power. And if you're an alcoholic, you know what that power is. I had arrived. I was there. There was no fear. I fit in for the first time in my life. I belong. About 15 minutes later, I was peeing on the front lawn of my new in-law's house, laughing, having the best time. Couldn't wait to get back to Brooklyn where I live. That's another story, being raised in Brooklyn. Just to let you know, you're not going to learn anything from me. Growing up in Brooklyn, I'm unscarred by education. In Brooklyn, we thought Moby Dick was a venereal disease. When they said, safe sex, practice safe sex, I locked the car door. We have no idea about education in Brooklyn. And I came back, and the first thing I did was go to the bars, and I realized I'm not afraid of women anymore. This is marvelous. I can go up. I can say, hi, can I buy you a drink? Before I even give you the drink, I said, let's go back to my place. And I've been afraid before that. And I started drinking. I got a great opportunity to go to Wall Street. I was terrified. I didn't know what to do. A friend of mine who gave me the opportunity said, just take people out and make them happy. I said, what do you mean, make them happy? He says, you have an unlimited expense account. I like that, having an unlimited expense account. And I started drinking, and I started taking people around entertaining, and whatever they wanted, I got them. And the funny thing started to happen. I started to drink at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and I started to drink at 11 o'clock, and I started to drink at 10 o'clock. And I found the love of my life, Glenfiddich Scotch. I was to love it like I would never love anything in my whole life. I loved it, I adored it, I cherished it. I took it with me in my attaché case. I became very successful in Wall Street. I had probably more than any human being is entitled to. I had the limousine with my own chauffeur, the antique Corvette, a home, and I don't mean a house, I mean a home, a Picasso hanging up on my wall. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank. And I came home one day, and I walked in the door, and the woman who's now my ex-wife said, did you have a good day? And I took my attaché case, threw it at her, and I said, damn it, as soon as I walk into the darn house, you gotta question me. I'm going out to play cards. And I went to my favorite place, Joe Dunn's in Staten Island, little topless place. I met the girl of my dreams. We moved in together. A year and a half later, the telephone rang. It was one hell of a card game. I picked up the phone. I said, hello. The little voice said, hello. I said, who's this? The voice said, daddy, this is your son, David. Do you remember me? And I was so hurt. I was so shaking. I was so embarrassed. I said, I'll call you back, and I hung the phone up. And I had tried to stop drinking many times. I had flushed more scotch down the toilet bowl. I swore I'm never going to ever drink again. I give you my solemn oath, I'm not drinking. I hadn't bathed, brushed my teeth, or changed my underwear in 9 months. One would say I was just living, existing to drink. Here I go into the fetal position in the corner, wishing to die. I can't drink and I can't not drink. I was in that place in between. I needed something so bad. I needed a drink of alcohol. Now, I only drink when fitted scotch, because I'm a big shot. But here I am, crawling into the bathroom to drink a bottle of soap. I needed it. I had to have it. And I couldn't stay in that apartment. There were trees that were scaring me. There were shadows coming in from under the door. I was in the DTs. I didn't even know what the DTs was. All I knew was I had to have something to drink. And I made a call to the only person who I had left in the whole world. They came, they took me out of that dirty, disgusting apartment. Had to physically carry me out. I was 70 pounds less than I am now. I looked like I just got out of a Nazi concentration camp. And I had been there. And they bathed me, took me to a barber, got my hair cut, and shipped me off to a rehabilitation center. It was a 28-day program. I stayed 40 days. I had to go see the psychiatrist after I finished detoxing. All I can remember is shaking and screaming and banging my head against the wall and them giving me Advan and more Advan and more Advan. And they told me I slept for 3.5 days. And I'm sitting in with the psychiatrist. And after about 15 minutes, he says, you know, you're very narcissistic. I said, I am not. He said, no, no, you're very narcissistic. I've never seen someone as narcissistic as you. I said, I am not. I like women, not guys. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. I couldn't comprehend anything. He asked me if I see little furry animals running around that nobody else does. So where the hell am I? And I gave him my pat answer, not since noontime. I just didn't understand what was going on. All I understood was I was there 5 weeks, and I didn't know what the hell they were saying. But I kept hearing, go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Go to Alcoholics Anonymous. With 5 weeks without a drink in me, they tell me I can get a pass to go to town. And somebody said, Larry, there's a bar there. Be careful. And I saw that glass of scotch overflowing. And I knew if I went, I'm drinking. Boy, I wanted a drink. I just wanted a drink more than I wanted anything in the whole world. I'll give you my life. Just give me a drink. I don't care. I just want a drink. And I stayed another few weeks, and they sent me home. And I went to Staten Island, and I did what I heard. My name's Larry. I'm new. I need a sponsor. Can someone sponsor me? And nobody came up. And I watched outside the meeting, and I saw some guy in a suit, a shirt, and a tie get into a Lincoln Continental. I said, he's for me. And I went up to him. I said, I need a sponsor. Would you please be my sponsor? He said, yes. 7 days later, I went out and drank again. He said to me, I will no longer be your sponsor. You don't want it bad enough. Now, I came back to meetings, and you guys applauded. You guys clapped. You welcomed me back. You hugged me. You loved me. You said, don't drink, go to meetings. Don't drink, go to meetings. And I got that in my head. I have the knowledge. You see, I told you, I'm from Brooklyn. I'm not well educated. I'm unscarred from education. Knowledge doesn't help me. I knew not to take the first drink. I knew what happens to me. And there I am drinking again. And I go back to a meeting again, and I hear, don't drink, go to meetings, and I drink again. And somehow in my head, I kept hearing, if I just don't drink, I'll be okay. There's my problem out there, the alcohol. If I just don't take that alcohol, I'm going to be fine. And I drank. And I drank again, and I drank again. And people told me I didn't want it bad enough. They said, if you wanted it bad enough, you wouldn't do it. And I was confused as Chinese arithmetic. sitting in here with you guys. And I hate every one of you son of a bitches. Why do I have to be the one constitutionally incapable of being honest? Why do I have to be on the outside looking in again? Why can't I get it, dear God? What's the matter with me? Why can't I be happy like all you people? And I don't ever want to drink again. God, I don't want the pain, the misery, the isolation, degradation. I don't want to drink again. And here I am in a bar. I'm drinking. And I go back to meetings. And they tell me it's the first one. And I'm the genius that ordered 12 shots of scotch, left the first one, had 2 through 12, and said, you people don't know what the hell you're talking about. But of course I went back and had number one. And I couldn't understand what you're talking about. You told me don't project, keep it in the now. And then you told me make 90 meetings in 90 days. I don't know what's going on in here. You told me all I had to do was clean ashtrays, sweep, and set chairs up, the ABCs, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs, and go to these meetings and I'll be fine. And I'm going to these meetings and I'm drinking. And after my 18th relapse, I heard the message. You guys ready for the message? Guy told me if you're sitting on a railroad track, it's the first one that gets you, the locomotive. And I got it. It's the first drink that gets you. I got it. And 3 days later, I'm in a bar drinking again. You see, I got the knowledge. I got all the knowledge. If it's only about knowledge, that it's the first one that gets you, why don't I just tattoo it on my hand? It's the first one that gets you, don't drink. Why don't I hang a sign on the door where I'm leaving? Why don't I hang one in the bathroom? Then all I got to do is not drink and come here. But you see, they didn't know about the sick, insane alcoholic mind that at a certain time doesn't have a defense. And that's what I had. And I didn't know what the hell's going on. I'm telling you I'm an alcoholic. If you say, why are you an alcoholic? Well, I smacked up 7 cars. I made 4 detoxes. I made 3 rehabs. I stole everything I ever gave my wife and my son. When I drink, I lose my job. That's why I'm an alcoholic. All of those things, or any one of them, does not make me an alcoholic. That's only the consequences of drinking. I didn't understand. I didn't have the answer that I need to know. What's wrong with me? What's my problem? And a big guy, a heavy guy, full of love and spirituality, who knew about the sick, insane, alcoholic mind that at a certain time does not have a defense, came up to me. And he said, if you want to call a friend, call me. And he put his hand on me and touched me. Everyone else had been running away from me in Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you don't want it, kid. I called him. I said, I need help. Please help me. Please be my sponsor. I was willing to turn my life and my will over to another human being. I was willing to do whatever he told me, bar none. I don't care what it is. I'll do it. He said, you ready? I said, yeah, I'm ready. He said, when you think about a drink or you want a drink, don't you dare call me. Don't you dare call another alcoholic. And especially, don't you dare go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You say, dear God, please take away the obsession, compulsion, thought, and desire for me to drink today. He pointed me right to the power. He said, after you go to the power, then you can call me, then you can call an alcoholic, then you can go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, we in Alcoholics Anonymous cannot fix your sick, insane mind. We cannot keep you sober. He says, haven't you proven that? And I said, yeah. I said, but I can't say that prayer. He said, why? I said, I don't believe in God. He said, do you believe I believe? I said, yes. He said, could you say it to my God? I said, okay, I'm not too bright at this time. I'll do anything he tells me to do. And a miracle happened. I wanted a drink. I said, dear God, please take away the obsession, compulsion, thought and desire for me to drink. And I called up one of you guys and I told you what happened. And a funny thing happened. I don't want to drink. And now I'm sober a long time, 3 days. It's proof it works. 3 days, man. That's a long time when you want to drink every second of every day. I'm in these rooms, I heard some guy talk about shooting heroin. The hell with that, I want to shoot scotch, man. What the hell's the matter with these people? And I go up to the Southeast New York Conference, and I hear this wonderful, gorgeous Native American Indian named Guy. He said, I'm the Maine guy from Maine. He was from Maine. And he said, I welcome you to the fellowship. This is not the program of recovery. This is the fellowship. I never heard this before. I thought I was in the program going to meetings. And he started to explain that the program of the 12 suggested steps, and there are exact, precise, clear-cut directions on how to do them from the title page in the big book to page 164, and that includes the spiritual experience. And I knew it was the truth. Nothing else worked for me. I had nothing to lose. And I came back to Staten Island, and I went through step one, and I saw it was me. I saw once I start drinking, I can't control the amount I get. I get a craving for more. Beyond my mental control, I can't stop. And I see my main problem, centers in my mind. I don't have a defense against it. And here's the kicker. At a certain time, like putting my hands on the hot coal, I don't have a sick mind, says, let me go burn my hand again. But where alcohol is concerned, I go back to it and go back to it, even though it gives me more pain, misery, degradation, isolation. I keep going back to it. And I saw the problem is physical here, the craving, mental here. And I remembered what was read here. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And I got to page 24 in the program recovery, and it told me the most powerful desire to stop drinking will be of no avail. My desire to stop drinking was of no avail. I proved it. I didn't want to drink again, and here I am drinking. And I saw the problem was not out there. I saw alcohol had never been my problem. Alcohol was my solution. It fixed me. It took care of the spiritual malady. I belonged. I fit in at last. I was not set aside. I was not a distinct entity when I drank. I belonged. I saw that I had to concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And I conceded physically, and I conceded mentally. I did not surrender. I did a concession. I conceded. And I went into step two. Based upon, with a sick, insane, alcoholic mind like I have, I'm screwed. I'm going to drink again. So the first step became, not that I can't drink, the first step was, I'm going to drink. My experience abundantly confirmed it. I couldn't fix my mind. Could any of you people fix my mind? The program told me, no person, a group of people can fix my mind. I'm going to have to start yelling because I keep going louder and louder. Imagine what my poor wife puts up with. All you're hearing is passion. All you're hearing is love. Because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you guys and you gals. Because without you, I'd be in the pits of hell. And I went into step two to be willing to believe. Just willing to believe that maybe there's a power greater than alcohol. And I saw the bedevilments on page 52. I can't control my emotional natures, my feelings. I'm prey to misery, depression. I'm unhappy. I can't make a living that fulfills me. And I'm asked, just go fix yourself. And I see lack of power as my dilemma. I do not have the power to fix me. And I came upon a new powerlessness. You see, I saw my powerlessness in the first step over alcohol. But I was kind of screwy with, am I really powerless over alcohol when there's none in me? And I had to take three words, power, control, and choice. And it had to be, it's like I'm in a wheelchair, like Superman used to be, paralyzed, I can't move. Do I have the power to get up and walk out of that wheelchair and walk out the door? Do I have a choice whether I can get up out of that wheelchair and walk out the door? Do I have the control to get up out of that wheelchair and walk out the door? And my answer is no. And I have to ask myself a question. Is it possible if I lost any one of those things, power, control, choice, I lost all three? Like, if I lost the power over something, didn't I lose the control and the choice? If I lost the choice, didn't I lose the control and the power? If I lost the control, didn't I lose a choice and power? So I start to see if I lose any one of those things, power, control, choice, I lost all three. And then I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and I hear, I have a choice whether to drink or not today. If you have a choice, what are you doing here? Just choose not to drink. I lost that choice. I have to drink with a sick, insane mind, like I have. I must drink. And that scared me. That terrified me. And I saw I was powerless over all of this stuff on the inside, and I can't fix me again. So I'm really, really screwed. And then I had to really take a leap of faith. And I had to make my first choice, which is the most restricting but the most freeing, that either God is everything or God is nothing. Either God is or He isn't. What was my choice to be? And I had to choose that God was everything. Because if God's nothing, I'm screwed. I got to live like this, with the pain, misery, isolation, degradation. And I went into step three. And that was all about me, selfish and self-centered. I saw the root of the disease. I saw the only decision I ever saw in step three, that I had to quit playing God. Hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be my director. He's the principal. He's the boss. I'm the agent. I work for Him. He's my father. I'm His child. And in order to consummate that decision, I get on my knees and I say the third step prayer. But before I did that, there was a requirement. And I think a lot of us fail because we're not convinced of the first requirement. Remember the first step. They told me I was going to have to do things I would not like. Now all of a sudden, I'm faced with a requirement that my life run on my will can hardly be a success. If I'm not absolutely convinced of that, why would I want to turn my life and my will over to something else? And I got on my knees and I made my first surrender to a power that was greater than alcohol. Now I'm not asking anyone in here to share that perception with me. I had a sponsor who I loved dearly. His name was Joe Hawk. He sponsored me for 17 years. And Joe and Mark Houston came in to do a big book weekend. And Joe was goofing on me because Joe believed you surrender in the first step. And I told him, I believe you surrender in the third step. And Mark was walking by. He said, Mark, come here. He He said, do you believe, Larry, he surrenders in the third step, not the first? And Mark said, yeah, me too. So my sponsor, who gave me more than anybody in this world, had a different perception. You see, we're allowed to have different perceptions in this book, as long as we follow what we believe are the exact clear-cut directions, will come out on the other side. I had the pleasure of going up to Bill Wilson's house. Chris had invited me up and to share on first-year sponsorship. And I heard the lady up there read a letter from Sister Ignatius, who said she was so touched to see alcoholics make their first surrender and get down on their knees and say their third step prayer. And I said this prayer, and something happened. God came to me. He overwhelmed me. I got down on my knees. I started to cry. I had a new creator, a new father. I was reborn. I went to meetings. I told you guys. They said, watch out. He lost it. But anything's better than the way I was. And I also saw at the end of the third step where it said, though this decision, step three, was vital and crucial, it will have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that block us from this power that I need. So they're telling me to face step four and be rid of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Strenuously, vigorously now. They're telling me to do steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 now. And I went into step 4 with 1 intent. To see what's blocking me from this power that I need. I saw a lot of things that I didn't like in step 4. I saw all my selfishness, all my self-seeking. And boy, was that guy right. Was I narcissistic. Never cared about you. Never cared about anyone. All I cared about was me, how I felt. It didn't matter if I hurt you as long as I felt good. And I went into step 5. And I didn't want to tell my sponsors stuff. I didn't want to tell them. I went to an after-hours club and I picked up Beverly. And I woke up in the morning next to Bernie. Because I ain't telling nobody stuff like that. Because real men don't do stuff like that. But that's my experience. Did anyone here ever have a blackout? Anyone? A couple of you guys look like Bernie, but... And I told my sponsor that. He said, you too? Nothing I told him affected him. Nothing at all. And I went into step 6 and 7. And I made my mistake in step 6 and 7. You see, I took a 100% God-reliant program and I turned it into a Larry's going to fix it now. And I'm going to be more kind, loving, caring, giving. And I pulled it off for a day and a half. And I went into step 8 and I went into step 9. And I went into step 10, and I went into step 11, and I went into step 12 to help others. And the obsession, compulsion, thought, and desire for me to drink was taken away. I ain't holding on a day at a time. It's just removed. I don't know where it went. Because before I started to go through the program recovery, I wanted to drink every second of every day. I'm jumping on tables at meetings. You people are crazy. All I want to do is drink. Now the obsession's gone. But I'm still insane. I'm still nuts. I'm still full of resentment. And God in His infinite way always gives me what I need. With 2 years sobriety, I get a set of tapes by Joe Hawk. And I made my mistakes in step 6 and 7. I had turned the God Reliance program into a Larry Reliance program. And I went out I went through the steps again. And I made a list when I got to 8 of all persons I had harmed. And I really believe when they say all persons, they really mean all. And I told you I'm unscarred by education. I'm not well educated, but I really know what the word all means. And I think a lot of times alcoholics have trouble with that big word. All is all. I didn't go into 9 and I didn't make lists of people I want to make amends to, people I think I might be able to make amends to, people I'm never going to make amends to, and people maybe in the next life I'll make amends. How could I go into step 9 if I haven't completed step 8? And I became willing to make amends to them all. I knew I had to, or I knew I'd drink again. I knew if I didn't turn my life and my will over to the care of God, I knew if I didn't have that first requirement, my life run on my will, I'm dead. I knew I couldn't decide what I wanted to do and what I did want to do. And I went out and I attacked my amends. And I made up about 140 amends in about 9 months. And I left 3. Left 3. I went into step 10. Started to do my spot check inventory. Started to carry the vision of God's will into all my activities today. Didn't know what that meant. Carry the vision of God's will. How do I think this God that I found through you people wants me to be? Kind, loving, caring, and giving to all his kids. Went into step 11. It says at night I constructively did my nightly inventory. It said in the morning we asked God to direct my thinking. I really asked God to direct my thinking. It said through prayer and meditation. I did prayer. I hated meditation. It was torture. I don't know if anyone in here has that problem. I see a few heads going. Meditation was torture. And then I spoke to this guy, Joe. I had been helping people. I had been doing groups. And I now was attempting to do a group of 30 people to go through the steps. And I got a call from 2 girls I had helped. And they were at a retreat. And they called up. They asked me if this guy Sydney and Loretta could come. And they were from Harlem. And I said, sure, I'm starting tomorrow. They said they'll be there. And I would read a chapter. I would play the CD from Joe. And this guy Sydney was amazed. He says, I met Joe. But it didn't happen. Nothing happened. And that's all he had to tell me. My ego went up to the ceiling. Look at me. I'm special. And he called Joe up and he told him about this guy he met that's taking people through the steps using his CD. Joe said, have the guy call me. I called him up and we're talking. He said, you've been through the program of recovery, I guess. And my ego's up to the ceiling. I said, many times. He says, how many amends do you have left? I said, 3. He said, I guess you've never been through the whole program of recovery, have you? Wow. And I have an uncanny ability when I see truth not to justify or rationalize. I said, yes, I've never been through the whole program of recovery. And he gave me an exercise. And I had 15 amends. And he told me to go out and do them and let him get back to him when I had 3. 9 days later, I called him back. I said, I have 3. He gave me another exercise. I had 22. Go through my phone book. See who I'm blocked from. And I went and I made the amends and I finished them. And I was able to be alone at perfect ease with my Creator. I was able to be free. It's been a wonderful, wonderful journey for me. And I'm truly the guy that you would walk over in the gutter. That's where I had gravitated down to. I was talking with Chris before. And I not only had a... I'm very lucky. I'm blessed, as we all are in here. And I not only had a spiritual experience, I had a spiritual awakening. And there's a huge, huge difference. From the narcissistic, selfish, self-centered, I hate to even say human being that I used to be, my body, mind, and spirit got awakened to help God's kids. I get up 4 o'clock in the morning to go to work. I come home Monday, I work with an alcoholic. I come home Tuesday, I work with an alcoholic. I come home Wednesday, I work with an alcoholic. Thursday's a day off, because I go to my home group, we stay late, and getting up so early, I'm just beat down. Friday, I work with an alcoholic. I now teach a meditation class on Saturday and work with an alcoholic and work with two. And I'm the guy that hated meditation. My sponsor was in Dharamsala, India. He was living with the Dalai Lama's teacher. And he came back a changed man. And I asked him, what happened? He said, meditation. And I knew meditation was the answer. And I found a simple Tibetan Buddhist monk on Staten Island who taught me to meditate a meditation called Tonglen. And I truly was rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. It was one of the toughest things I've ever done. It took me 6 weeks just to learn to sit there. My feet hurt, my back hurt, everything hurt. But I knew that was another answer. And I knew I had to grow in here. I knew I could just not flatline. I know if I just stay here, I'm going to regress back. I knew I had to grow in understanding and effectiveness. You know, I sponsored a girl. Still sponsor her. And I said to her, what are you doing to grow in understanding and effectiveness? She said, I'm working with 4 alcoholics. I said, weren't you working with 4 alcoholics 6 months ago? She said, yeah. She said, I'm praying and meditating. I said, weren't you praying and meditating 6 months ago? She said, I go to meetings, the fellowship. I said, weren't you doing that 6 months ago? Then what are you doing to grow in understanding and effectiveness? I got to know what you guys are doing. Helps me. If it works for you guys, it'll work for me. I like to talk about what I do to stay sober. Nothing. I didn't get sober. God got me sober. I used to think I had the ability to help someone get sober. God gets them sober. Not Larry. I sat down this afternoon and I just started to contemplate a little bit. And I just wanted to read a few words that came out to me to stress the difference between self-reliance and God-reliance. Because you see, at the beginning, I was pointed towards that has power over alcohol with that simple prayer. And on page 43, it says, been brought into a way of living. I get brought, taken, rocketed, propelled, thrust. I don't have the power to do it. I get brought into a way of living. Raised from the dead, suddenly taken. I don't do it. Alcoholic problem was taken away. Talk about a miracle of healing. There has been a revolutionary change. I get changed. I don't change me. I can't fix me. I don't have the power to fix me. If I don't have the power to fix me, why should I work on me? It's a waste of time. We believe in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death, catapulted into what I call the fourth dimension. Thrown. I don't go there. I get catapulted. Before I close, there's something that touched me that I read at a meeting in Manhattan, and a lot of people hadn't heard it, and they were touched. So if you'll allow me to read two pages, it's called The Thread in Our Lives. It goes, a mouse looked through the crack in the wall to see the farmer and his wife open a package. What food might this contain, the mouse wondered. He was devastated to discover it was a mouse trap. Retreating to the farmyard, the mouse proclaimed the warning. There's a mouse trap in the house. There's a mouse trap in the house. The chicken clucked and scratched, raised his head and said, Mr. Mouse, I can tell this is grave concern to you, but there is no consequence to me. I cannot be bothered by it. The mouse turned to the pig and told him, there's a mouse trap in the house. There's a mouse trap in the house. The pig sympathized and said, I'm so sorry, Mr. House, but there is nothing I can do about it but pray. Be assured you're in my prayers. The mouse turned to the cow and said, there's a mouse trap in the house. There's a mouse trap in the house. The cow said, well, Mr. Mouse, I'm sorry for you, but it's no skin off my nose. So the mouse returned to the home, head down, dejected, to face the farmer's mouse trap alone. That very night, a sound was heard through the house, like the sound of a mouse trap catching its prey. The farmer's wife rushed to see what was caught in the darkness. She did not see it was a venomous snake whose tail the trap had caught. The snake bit the farmer's wife. The farmer rushed her to the hospital, and she returned home with a fever. Everyone knows you treat fever with fresh chicken soup. So the farmer took his hatchet to the farmyard for the main ingredient. But the wife's sickness continued, so friends and neighbors came to sit with the farmer's wife around the clock. To feed them, the farmer butchered the pig. The farmer's wife did not get well. She died. So many people came to a funeral, the farmer had the cow slaughtered to provide enough meat for all of them. The mouse looked upon it from the crack in the wall with great sadness. So the next time you hear someone is facing a problem and think it doesn't concern you, remember, when one of us is threatened, we are all at risk. We are all involved in this journey called life. We must keep an eye out for one another and make an extra effort to encourage one another. Thank you for listening.